created by black holes. But
Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, coming to you live from Rochester, New York. Thanks for joining me today on the Paranormal Radio Network. And just a reminder, you can also hear us now on UPRN 105.7 FM in New Orleans. And for more information on the show and on my guests, visit my website at www.keyholepublishing.com. And just want to warn you, I have been having some internet problems lately, so if you go to the site and you don't find up-to-date information, be patient with me. I'm fighting with the internet, and as soon as some of these storms in Rochester clear up, maybe I'll be able to get that posted. As always, I want to hear from you during the show, so if you're listening live tonight, be sure to join us on the message board to discuss the program and add your questions and comments. Go to ParanormalRadioNetwork.com, and you can join us in the virtual auditorium there and participate in the conversation through instant messaging. You can email me also anytime with your questions and comments. My email address is kdolan@rochester.rr. Or if you prefer, you can always call into the show toll-free. That number is 1-877-786-0562. And if you missed any of that, it's all on the webpage at www.keyholepublishing.com. My guest this evening is the author of a new book on the TV show Supernatural. It's called The Mythology of Supernatural, The Signs and Symbols Behind the Popular TV Show. I have been a huge fan of that show for about the last year since I heard about it from my sister, who just said, you know, it's kind of cool, it's pretty funny, you should check it out. I got hooked big time. My whole family got hooked big time as soon as I got them to watch it. It's a great show. It's a lot of fun. And I have to say that when I first heard about this book, I was thinking, well, that's kind of cool because there's a lot of really good lore, as they call it in the show. There's a great deal of mythology that I recognized from other sources as I was watching the show. It's not completely just written for this show. Well, my guest this evening, Nathan Robert Brown, is an expert in mythology and world religions, and when he saw the show, he started doing some digging and actually tracked down the sources of a lot of these things, put them together in a book, which sounded like a cool idea, but I thought this could be kind of scholarly and dry. But I got to tell you, it's fantastic. This is scholarly. It is not dry. Reading this book is about as much fun as watching the show. So if anybody needs a fix, because we're on summer hiatus here and, you know, no new coming out yet, check out this book, The Mythology of Supernatural. It's available on Amazon now. And Nathan, thank you so much for joining me tonight on Through the Keyhole.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, I have just so been enjoying reading this book. I read it, I blew right through it when I first got a copy, and then I was just rereading it again in preparation for our interview this evening. And I'm just loving it. I absolutely am having as much fun reading this book as I do watching the show.
And I'm so glad to hear that.
Well, it's a really difficult thing to do, I think. You know, to write something that has as much information in it as this book does, but to still be so much fun.
Well, the show made that a lot. It made that pretty easy, to be honest with you. You know, the show it plays with mythology. It's so playful, really, in nature with the lore and the mythology. And so, you know, I kind of became a fan of the show as I was writing the book. And when I first started writing it, believe it or not, it did at first start off kind of sounding too academic. And I wanted the book to feel the way the show feels. And so a lot of what I did, I really wrote this book so it gave you the same kind of mood and tone the show has. Excuse me. And so I included, you know, a lot of stuff from the show. I use a lot of the show's terminology when I'm talking about things so that way it doesn't feel like it's just some you know, highbrow mythologist just rattling away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would have been so easy to make this really dry and academic. I actually, you know what, I've seen a few other attempts at this sort of thing, and I couldn't get more than a few pages in, which amazes me because just the topic, all these paranormal topics, and, you know, talks about beliefs about spirits from different times in history and different parts of the world should be fascinating in itself. I guess it's possible to suck the life out of just about anything, but, I mean, the way you used quotes from the show, I thought, really was a great way of interjecting some humor, because most of those quotes are really funny. And they illustrate your points beautifully. You know, where it could get dry and it could get a little esoteric, then you insert something Bobby said with idiot at the end, and yeah, now we know what he's saying.
Right.
Love Bobby.
Yeah, and that's, I love Bobby King. When I first started writing the book, I tried to be very close with the supernatural fandom when I was writing it. You know, I made updates on, you know, Facebook and Twitter with the fans of the show and got their input on stuff. And it was funny because when I started to post pictures of, you know, my profile pictures on Facebook and Twitter, I got a lot of these, "You look like a young, chubby Bobby Singer." And I was like, oh, great. Thanks a lot for that. I'm not sure if that was a compliment or not. I don't know how to feel about that.
Wow. So how did you get into this? I mean, you were already something of an expert in this field, in mythology and world religions, before you started this project. Am I right? I mean, you have other books. You wrote The Complete Idiot's Guide to World Mythology and World Religions at Your Fingertips, and one called The Wraith of Lilith, which I really want to see.
Oh, that was a work of passion. The Rape of Lilith was that. My mythological studies. I started studying mythology in college. Well, I've been studying it my whole life, but formally in college after I got out of the military. You know, I went into college, and one of my professors was one of Joseph Campbell's students, Dr. Evans Lansing Smith, and I was like, oh my gosh, as a direct student of Joseph Campbell's as a professor in my college, I freaked out. Oh. Followed him around campus all the time until I think I was creeping him out for a while. But he and I actually ended up writing The Idiot's Guide to World Mythology together.
Oh, cool.
And, pardon me, I'm coughing a lot today. As I started studying mythology, you know, went into grad school with my master's degree and stuff, I realized that, I kind of had an interest in demonology as well, so I started kind of focusing my mythological studies into kind of the myths and lore surrounding demons, and that ended up kind of leading to me doing The Idiot's Guide to the Paranormal and Werewolves, and then I wrote a zombie novel, a novella a few years ago, and that got me to write The Idiot's Guide to Zombies, and then it just seemed like all that was just a natural progression to the mythology of supernatural.
So how did you hear about the TV show? I think I read somewhere that some friends of yours said, hey, you got to check this out.
Well, yeah. Well, the reason they told me I had to check it out first was because the Jensen Ackles, who plays Dean Winchester, went to the same junior high I did at the same time.
Oh, you're kidding me.
So, yeah, we both went to Apollo Junior High in Richardson, Texas, and he was actually in seventh grade at the same time as I was, in eighth and ninth. We ran in different circles, though. He was kind of one of the cool kids. He was one of the cool kids that didn't beat me up, though, so I can say that much. But we didn't really run in the same circles around that time period. And so I just thought it was funny that a kid I kind of knew in junior high would end up doing a TV show, and then I would end up writing a book about it. It was just really a weird coincidence. And so some friends were like, you know, hey, you know, check out the show. This is a guy we went to school with. And so I went and checked the show out. And I was like, this is incredible. And that was around, that was towards the end of season four, actually. And the odd thing was, just as I started watching it, my agent sends me an email and says, hey, Berkman's interested in doing a book on Supernatural. Do you know anything about it? And I lost it. Yes, I know everything about it. And so, you know, and then plus I had done a book on Lilith, and they really wanted me to have a whole chapter devoted to the Lilith subject. And so that was one of the big concerns. They were worried about what kind of person they were going to get to write a book where they did have a whole chapter on Lilith, because it was such a complicated subject. But since my entire master's thesis was dedicated to Lilith and then was expanded into a book for VDM Verlag Publishing in Germany, and I'm actually planning on republishing it, an even further expanded copy of it here in the near future. Oh, preferably one that's not 70, because VDM Verlag, they charge a lot for academic titles, unfortunately.
Wow. I'm just sitting here blown away. I mean, I had not spoken with you before, you know, just a few minutes ago, really, and I was reading this book and really just loving it, and then I looked at your background and I saw, oh, he's written all these books on mythology and world religions, and I'm thinking, I'm going to get this, you know, middle-aged, maybe older professor-type guy, and I'm talking to you, you sound much younger than I thought you would be.
I just turned 34 yesterday.
Oh, well, yeah, you're way younger than I thought you were.
I stay busy.
Professor, graying, you know. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I try to stay busy. You know, and I kind of live in fast forward, so yeah, people, that's why I grew a beard, because people tend to have that reaction. They're expecting a middle-aged man, and then I walk into the room, and they're like, but you're just a child, and so I grew a beard, because I tend to evoke that reaction, because I also have a baby face, which doesn't help me at all.
Do you find the beard helps people take you more seriously?
It seems like it, yeah. It honestly does. When I do public speaking, I noticed that at first when I started doing it, I didn't have the beard. I kind of got that you're so young reaction a lot, and then I grew the beard, and I haven't heard it since, so I think the beard's going to be sticking around for a while, I guess.
Well, I don't think I meant it quite in that way. I see what you're saying, but I was thinking more like, you're just talking about all these books that you've written, and I'm thinking, how do you find the time for all of this? I mean, I'm just amazed at the number of projects you've done.
Well, I was very lucky in the sense, not lucky, but blessed in the sense that when I got out of the military, I went into college, and I had the GI Bill, and I had a lot of family support, so I had a couple of years to do nothing but write and study. And I took full opportunity of it. That's all I did for 2 years was read mythology books, study, and just write and write and write and write. And I think over those 2 years, I sent about 300 inquiry letters and writing samples to different agents, and I got one reply. And that one reply ended up having me write a book that has absolutely nothing to do with mythology at all, but it got my foot in the door, and I wrote a few books on just kind of ghostwriting or helping, working as co-authors, people who were experts on a subject but not necessarily writers, and helping them kind of get their words into, or get their thoughts into words. Mm-hmm. And then eventually that led me into the area I wanted to write about. But it took me a few years, and so, you know, I'm one of those people who I would not let an opportunity. If I see an opportunity, I take it. And that philosophy has served me very well. I've been very blessed in that regard.
Well, that's great. That should be a lesson to all of us, you know, to just go after the things that we really, really want to do, which it sounds like. What exactly was it that you were pursuing? You said, you know, you were working on this and that, and then you finally got a chance to go after what you really wanted. What was it that you really wanted to get into?
Well, what I really wanted to get into, to be honest, when I was, you know, an early 20-something, I really wanted to write fiction. That's what I thought I wanted. I thought I really wanted to write fiction. And mainly because I had never tried writing nonfiction. And so a lot of my original works were related to fictional books. And then after a while I thought, you know, maybe I should try writing some nonfiction. And that was actually when I started sending out writing samples. And so I would include a fiction writing sample and a nonfiction writing sample. And then I was also studying mythology around the time. And then eventually those two things I realized could be integrated. Just for whatever reason, had never occurred to me until after I'd done a few books that I could do that. And so what I really wanted to do by the time I was, you know, probably into my fourth or fifth book, was write narrative nonfiction. You know, write not, because a lot of times, like you said earlier, when you read nonfiction, it comes off as too highbrow and dry, and they use every $10 web, and it just makes it an absolute chore to read. And I realized what I could do, though, is take academic subjects and put them in words that people can, number one, understand, and number two, not want to, like, you know, choke themselves when I try to read it.
And we thank you for that. Because I'm one of those people. I mean, okay, I can get most of the material in these other nonfiction books, but if it's not fun to read, why am I going to bother? I mean, who has
right.
that kind of time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Unless I'm learning how to do something, then, okay, I'll put up with a lot in a nonfiction book if it's got information that I need. But something like this, I mean, okay, I'm not going to be conjuring up demons, but I do enjoy reading about it. And your book is just so much fun to read.
Would you mind terribly if I were just to read the dedication in your book?
Oh, no, please, go ahead. Be my guest.
Okay, I didn't want it to be like, oh, I'm giving away this really cool thing that's supposed to be a surprise, but I just loved it. This is one of the things, when I first got the book and I just flipped it open, the first thing I saw was, it says, this book is dedicated to the legendary 1967 Chevy Impala 327 V8 4-barrel, the only car with enough awesome to be driven into an apocalypse by Dean Winchester. That is so cool. I just said, okay, this is so absolutely not what I thought this book was going to be.
Well, you know, I actually struggled quite a bit with that dedication. I was like, what can I really dedicate this to? And the answer came to me at the end of season 5 in the finale, you know, because that was really in the original plan. The fifth season was really, that was the whole plan, was a 5-year, 5-season cycle. And that was going to be the end. And then they wanted to do a season 6. And so that got changed. But what I liked was how their original plan was to bring everything back to the car. You know, everything comes back to that Impala, because it's the one thing that kind of holds them all together. And I liked that. And so,
I never thought of that. I never really realized that. That's an excellent point.
And, you know, and then at the end of the show, you know, Michael and Lucifer are about to go at it, and you hear, and then here comes Dean driving the Impala, and I just realized at that moment that the book had to be dedicated to the car.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It absolutely is. It's the one thing that's really recurring. Although they did have two different cars, didn't they? In the first season, it was a different one. The car didn't look the same.
You mean, you're talking about the cars they had on the set or the cars in the show? Like, you mean like the car as a character or like the actual cars
Dean's
they used?
No, Dean's car. I seem to remember Reed saying that the first season it was a different car. It wasn't a 67 Impala. In the first season.
No, they couldn't find one at first. And so I want to say it was a 68 that they modified to make it a 67. Now, that's the kind of thing, I honestly don't know if I'm being 100% sure about that. I believe, though, that something was done to do that, because there was some kind of a delay with the 67s, and then what they ended up doing eventually was just taking the body of a 67, you know, fabricating or refurbishing old exteriors for 67 Impalas and putting them on chassis of other cars, because believe it or not, it's a very hard car to find. It's actually a very difficult car to find that doesn't already have an owner who's not willing to part with it. And, you know,
especially not now.
Well, and on top of that, you know, they're wanting to use it for a TV show, and very few people are willing to give up their beautiful pride and joy 67 Impala to put it on a TV show where they might try to crash it.
Yeah.
You know, there are any number of things they might try to do. And so, you know, I've looked around, and trust me, there that is one difficult car to find, and even more so now. There's no idea how many Supernatural fans have been looking for 67 Impalas for years.
Yeah, well, that's what I was just thinking, is now it would be almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I never really cared about owning a 67 Impala, but, boy, if I had a chance now, I'd snap one up in a second.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, believe it or not, I actually drive an Impala. This is a total coincidence, but I do. It's not a 67 Impala, but I do drive an Impala.
Yeah, I am really into cars, and I know when I was watching the first season, it drove me nuts because there was no identifying information on the car. There was no logo. There was no, you know, where the word Chevrolet is on the later Impala. There was nothing on it.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know, I love. Oh no, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I had this long discussion with my husband because I was driving him crazy. Because in the first several episodes that we watched, I kept saying, "My God, what is that car? That is such a great car. What is it? It's making me nuts." And he's like, "Could you just watch the show, please?" And finally, after we got a couple of episodes or a couple seasons actually into it, and then you could see it said Chevrolet right across the front. And he's like, "Well, there you go. It says right there, it's a Chevy." I'm like, "That wasn't on there before. That was a..." This whole argument about that. It's like, no, that wasn't there. So I think I ended up doing a Google search or something. I was like, yes, there were two different cars.
Well, the thing is, that's what I love about the show, is that, like when I was doing research, the fans helped me out so much because there's a lot of stuff that they introduce on the show, and they'll allude to things, but they won't just outright say it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love is how the fans of Supernatural will just rush in and be like, "Okay, we got to find out what this is," and they will. They'll figure it out. They figured out the yellow-eyed demon was Azazel before anyone knew.
Yeah, I remember reading that. That was fascinating. How long was it? I mean, the fans figured it out based on this very complicated Enochian symbol that somebody drew in order to summon that demon, but it was at least several episodes, or was it even into the next season before they actually named him on the show?
I think it was at least into the second season by the time they even said the name Azazel.
Wow.
I mean, he was just the yellow-eyed demon at that point, but they kind of tipped their hand because the creators, I think, were when they had that scene shot, they're like, no one's going to have any idea what this is. And if they do, good for them, you know, if they're going to figure this out. And so, you know, then the fans are like, you know, taking screenshots, and they go on the, you know, they go on a research hunt and just figure out that it's a sigil of Azazel, and that was really impressive.
Then it comes back to being really impressive that the writers actually used the real thing. You know, they used a sigil that someone could research and find somewhere.
Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised how much of the show does that. I mean, I had to really dig deep on a lot of the stuff that they have on the show. You know, like, for example, I'm familiar with, like, the Key of Solomon, you know, that entire text. And, you know, when they first introduced, like, the Devil's Trap, you know, Bobby Singer traps a demon underneath a seal that's on his ceiling. And it's not the Devil's Trap they end up using later, but it's supposed to be from the Seal of Solomon. And when I looked at it, I'm like, that is not in the Seal of Solomon. I know it's not. And so I went back and looked, and it actually is. But what they did was they took two separate symbols from the Key of Solomon and integrated them into one symbol.
Oh.
And I think the reason they did that was because it's supposed to be the real Key of Solomon, and there are several different versions of the Key of Solomon, and they all claim to be the authentic one, but most of them are most likely just frauds or fabrications or just someone's imaginative idea of what it might look like. And so I thought it was interesting that they would do that, because if it was a real Key of Solomon, then it would have a symbol that no one would be able to find in any of the existing copies. And I was running into stuff like that left and right as I was watching the show, you know, something, and it would be something that would be so obscure I'd have to go search for it. You know, like in Houses of the Holy, there's a scene where this spirit of a rogue priest is given his last rites, and the priest starts to recite a last rites. And I know the Roman last rites, and that wasn't what he was reciting. And I was like, well, what the heck is he saying? So I had to go and copy this down word for word and just search and search and search, and I find out that it's from an old pseudo-Catholic religious order called the Holy Order of Mans, and it hasn't even been in existence since 1984.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, and so, I'm like, how did these guys find this?
Yeah.
You know? it just blew my mind, and I was running into stuff like that all the time.
Did you ever, in your research, contact any of the actual writers for the show and ask them, you know, where did you guys come up with this stuff?
No. No, I did not.
Okay. It was
mainly because it's an unauthorized book, so I couldn't really try. I couldn't really use the people on the show as a resource.
Okay. No, that's fine. I was just curious to know, you know, the kind of things that you found out, just, it makes it so clear. I have so much respect for the writers because they did. They came up with these really obscure things.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they would take liberties with them for the sake of good TV. But
right.
You get the impression that wherever possible, they stuck with the originals as much as they could. You know, the original urban legend of Bloody Mary and the guy with the hook. You know, that was, what, like first season, second season?
Oh, the Bloody Mary episode? Oh, goodness. You know what, I'm going to be confused about it now because I just got through watching the anime last night. Someone bought it for me as a birthday gift, and they have a Bloody Mary episode in that, but it's a different episode in the anime than it is in the Supernatural series.
Okay.
And I can't remember which episode it is.
I just learned about the anime series just today. So
oh, really?
I didn't know it existed until this afternoon. Wow. So
well, I actually just found out about it a few weeks ago.
My daughter, but she might end up with that for her birthday because she's a huge fan of anime and of Supernatural.
Oh, well, good on her.
My 12-year-old, my 12-year-old daughter is like, you can have a conversation with her, and if you mention any teeny little incident, she'll immediately rattle off the season and the title.
Wow.
I think she's a little obsessive. But that's okay. You know, it's a good mental exercise. I mean, if she were a boy, she'd be doing it with baseball cards and baseball stats. I said, fine, you know, whatever.
Right.
But, yeah, she's good. I mean, if I want to watch a particular episode, I'm like, what was the one where Kel did? And she's like, oh, yeah, season 6, episode 2. Okay.
I can't even do that.
I can't, but I don't have to. I have her. So I got my resources. But then, you know, when we're watching it, she'll turn to me and she'll say, oh, my God, that thing they just talked about, is that real? Is that an actual legend? Or, you know, did they make that up? And 9 times out of 10, I'm like, yeah, that's real. I heard about that one years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't think of a single thing that they straight up fabricated. There were things that probably they could have, I don't know how to even put this. Like they're not necessarily just flat out made up. But there are some things that, you know, they added to the lore that doesn't exist in the lore. But I think a lot of that has to do with kind of that feeling of authenticity that the show has. Because, you know, obviously all myths are based on fact in somewhere along the line. But if you have these people and they're dealing with the reality, then the lore has got to be off in some areas. You know, the vampires, you know, you can only kill them by chopping off their heads. You can slow them down with a stake, or you can bring the head off part. It's definitely in vampire lore. But, they take out the wooden stake part. You know, and so I kind of like that. Like, for example, with the werewolf, you know, they keep the silver bullets, but werewolves don't actually turn into wolves. They just become wolf-like, but they remain, you know, they don't grow hair or anything like that. They just, you know, they get big teeth and claws and attack people.
Well, there have been ancient stories, though. I mean, that belief has been not very clear. I've read some very old legends. I think some of the ones from France where they actually, some of them did talk about people changing into a wolf-like being, but I thought there had been some where they actually talked about a wolf. In fact, you recounted a legend or a story from France, I think it was, in the werewolf section, where you did talk about this beast that was a huge wolf.
Oh, the Beast of Gévaudan, that was, no one really knows because, you know, they ended up, you know, tearing the wolf to pieces and parading it through the streets, and, you know, no one knows where the carcass of the wolf ended up. So this wolf was just, you know, or possibly a pack of these wolves was, you know, preying on the people around Gévaudan, and you know, they sent the best wolf hunters in Europe after this thing, and time and time again they thought they killed it, and time again the thing would come back. And that's where we actually get the whole Like, you know, there's kind of like the cult in Supernatural. You know, this hermit in Gavaudan took his hunting rifle and a few bullets up to Notre Dame and had them blessed by the monks and priests there, and then brought them back. And according to the lore, that's the weapon that killed the beast. Could have been a coincidence, maybe not, but that's where, and then later on, I guess, somewhere along the line, the bullet was made out of silver got added to it, so some people claim that's where we get the silver bullet thing, but no one's really sure about that, because silver was considered an element to ward off evil long before the silver bullet issue with the Gavaudan beast.
So where did that come from? Why is silver considered to be protection against evil?
Well, number one, I think it's because it's a rare element. Number one, it's kind of like iron, for example. So there were things they could do with silver, you know, like the process of gilding and things of that nature that they could use silver for. Silver didn't behave like other metals, so I think and it's pretty to look at. I think that probably had something to do with it. And, you know, iron took the place of silver. Right around the time of, you know, the Iron Age and the Middle Ages, you know, iron was the element that you warded off evil with for the most part. You know, like, for example, there's one old piece of werewolf lore that says you can throw an iron bar over the head of a werewolf and it'll make it powerless. It'll revert it back to human form and all that stuff. Or you tap it on the head with the iron bar. Same thing was supposed to work with witches back in the day. You know, we all know that most of those books were written about witches in the medieval and Middle Ages. Just absolute crap, but this was apparently something you could do.
They were mostly written during the trials by the people who were conducting the trials, and they were making up all kinds of horrible things.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, you know, they did the same thing, and, you know, just, you know, the whole thing about kidnapping children and eating them on Passover, and, you know, I find that the Christian church did a lot of that stuff around the Middle Ages. It was just absolutely insane.
Yeah. Really horrible. It's interesting what you brought up about iron, because I know you talked about that in the book as well. I'd always gotten used to thinking of the idea that, well, iron was considered to be magical because it was this new thing, and, I mean, it wasn't like a new combination. Bronze is actually a combination of metals. Iron is pure, but it was difficult to smelt it for a long time, and it was a while before we were able to actually make things out of pure iron. And so, yeah, I'm sure it seemed magical because it was so much stronger than bronze. And you did raise this point in the book as well, that what's considered magic might have something to do with magnetism, with energy, and iron is magnetic. And that it may have grounded or disrupted the flow of energy, and maybe that's why it was supposed to be proof against magic. It would ward it off because it would ground the magic coming at you.
Well, yeah, it seems to make sense, you know, because a lot of the people, a lot of the current theories about supernatural activity or paranormal activity is that there's this spike in electromagnetic energy in the air. And so the belief or the theory is that a lot of this activity requires a certain exertion of electromagnetic fields. And so if electromagnetic, and you were to, like, let's say you the spirit were to manifest itself in a visual apparition using this electromagnetic energy, then or to even make it where it could touch you or do something to you, the idea of, yeah, touching it with a piece of iron would, like, ground it or cause the energy to dissipate. So I thought it was kind of an interesting take on it. Because they don't use iron for everything. That's the interesting thing about it. And iron doesn't work against demons or any of the other, but only against ghosts and spirits. So I thought that was kind of interesting that they stuck with the iron only when it came to ghosts and spirits. They didn't try to make it like a universally potent substance, except with the fairies, you know, then it worked in that situation.
It's a fairly low level. Like, it's kind of a low-level weapon against low-level bad guys, I guess. You know, they could make a ghost or a spirit kind of lose its form temporarily, and then the spirit would kind of pull itself back together, but hopefully by then they'd have something stronger they could use against it.
Right, and you know, same with the rock salt, you know, and that's the other thing. It was something I didn't think of until after the book is, you know, that salt, as far as being a conductor is concerned, you know, salt water is considered a pretty conductive substance. And so I thought maybe after I had already gotten past my deadline, so I didn't have much time to like go and research and try to add this into the book. But I thought, you know, maybe that was why what they're thinking with the rock salt as well. But then, you know, that also worked against demons and things of that nature, which is also a common thing. You know, salt was considered a fertility substance or a purifying substance, and still is by most religions.
Now, that's interesting that it's considered, as you just said, a fertility substance, yet at the same time, if you, you know, sow the ground with salt, that will destroy fertile farmland.
Right.
I mean, that's totally opposite.
Well, I shouldn't say not so much fertility as I should say maybe prosperity. It is fertility. But I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, with during the non-fertile periods, you know, the winters and things of that nature, salt allowed people to preserve their foodstuffs when they couldn't grow food to survive the winter months. So in that sense, it was a very fertile substance in that it allowed life to continue during the non-growing seasons.
It just made me think it's an interesting sort of metaphor that, you know, if you have too much purity, you can't live with that either. You can't grow more food if you have this salt
all things
ground.
In balance.
Exactly. See, we need a little bit of that impurity. I am absolutely in favor of a little impurity now and then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I honestly think that we could get rid of a lot of the ideological crap that kind of messes with people spiritually and psychically if we could just tell everybody to live. Don't worry about the rest.
And don't worry about
your
neighbor.
We worry far too much about it. Yes.
You know, take yourselves, you know, take care of your own life and stop looking at what everybody else is doing, honestly.
Mm-hmm. And that's also one of the things I like about Supernatural is that even though, yeah, a lot of the stuff they use is from Judeo-Christianity, you know, those traditions, they're not... what's the word I'm looking for? They're not exclusive to Judeo-Christianity. You know, they take stuff from Wicca, they take stuff from the early pagan traditions. You know, they don't ever say any one religion's got it right. Even in the apocalypse, you know, all the pre-Christian gods all get together in a hotel to kind of, like, you know, talk about their all upset because they all want their apocalypse to happen. They don't want the Judeo-Christian apocalypse to happen. So, but, you know, I like that about the show, the whole of this openness of spirituality, you know, and the fact that, you know, when they go to heaven, a lot of the people that they say shins are Jews. And so I like that because then you don't have to worry, you know, okay, you know, is this the Christian only heaven? You know, like, I like that about the show, though, that it doesn't try to make itself religiously exclusive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was great. I was a little distressed by the idea that everyone had their own heaven. And, you know, Ash was only able to cross over to go visit people because he was a genius and he figured out how to break the rules. I thought it sounded kind of lonely.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, he was saying, you know, the soulmates could share their heavens, but for the most part people just had their own. But, yeah, that would sound a little iffy to me. You couldn't choose to go and visit.
Yeah. I mean, and I was surprised even at Pamela. I mean, she kind of liked it. She was totally okay with it. But I'm thinking, so what, you're kind of stuck in your own little room for the rest of eternity? That doesn't sound like fun.
Well, she got her eyes back, and, you know, she's got a 24-hour show at the Meadowlands, which I don't even know what that means, and, like, I can't imagine what a heaven that would be. Like, I don't know if she was using the metaphor or if she was being literal with that.
Yeah,
it
I don't know.
It sounds like a weird heaven to me. It sounds like a weird place.
But, again, it's different for everybody, so I guess you'd kind of have to be alone in your heaven because your heaven wouldn't be the same as everyone else's.
Right, I guess things would get muddled, you know, if you had two people trying to share heaven, everyone's ideas would be different, and it might, who knows, it might cause some kind of a problem, I guess, with how the show was set up as far as heaven was concerned. But, again, I do wish, though, that they would bring Ash back. I miss Ash so much.
He was a wonderful, wonderful character. I just the other night watched some of the early episodes again, and I saw the one, his first episode.
Mm-hmm.
And he just seemed like an absolute lunatic, and then he turned out to be a genius. It was so funny.
I love that he's sleeping on the pool table, I believe. When
yes.
You don't even notice he's there until he wakes up, and suddenly there's this guy on the pool table, and you didn't even notice he was laying there. I love that. That perfect introduction for that character.
Yeah. And they said, nice hair, and he said, yeah, all business up front, party in the back.
Party in the back.
He's amazing. So you said that you were interested in demonology before you got started in this?
Yes.
So you must have really taken to the whole demon aspect of Supernatural like a duck to water then.
Oh, yeah. For the most part, it's interesting how they set it up. But, I mean, there are differences, obviously. They got to make the show interesting. So there are some differences. You know, obviously, real demon possession is a little bit more complicated than what happened, than just, you know, the big black cloud shoving its way down somebody's throat on the show. But as far as the demons that they used, yeah, they did a great job with that. You know, the idea that Azazel is the one trying to free Lucifer, you know, that's actually a pretty impressive thing. Because if you look at, you know, like Azazel's story in the Book of Enoch, you know, the whole point about him is that he's been trapped under a desert called Dudael. It means like God's place of desolation, or the godless place is where he's basically trapped, and he's supposed to be trapped until Judgment Day. And so it's interesting that he's the one who comes to free Lucifer and start the apocalypse.
Right, so on Judgment Day, because then he gets out. I thought it was really cool the way they brought up, you know, what the apocalypse means to all the different demons. Because some wanted it, some didn't. Ruby was kind of afraid of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the thing I thought was interesting was that, you know, the whole idea that aside from, you know, demons with red eyes, for example, are crossroads demons, and crossroads spirits have been around in war since way, way before Christianity ever showed up, or even Judaism. And then you've got, you know, these color-eyed demons, which I believe are fallen angels, and then you have white-eyed demons, which are pre-Christian, like deities, usually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Samhain, Lilith. These are entities that were kind of demonized by the church later. And so the black-eyed demons, though, you know, we find out later, these are supposed to be basically spirits that have been corrupted by spending too much time in hell. And so, you know, these are actually human souls. And so it kind of starts to make sense that some of them wouldn't want the apocalypse to happen. Because what happens to them when the apocalypse happens? Because according to the Christian Bible, when the apocalypse happens, all that is evil, you know, the evil ceases to exist, basically, according to the Christian apocalypse. And you have the 1,000-year reign of peace and all that stuff. But again, though, my personal belief about the apocalypse is that evil ceases to exist because we stop dichotomizing. The two become one, basically. You know, if good and evil end up becoming one, then there can't be two, and so there's neither good nor evil, so of course there's no evil. Mm-hmm. But I like how, you know, they kind of played with that in the book, or in the movie, or TV show. I'm having one of those days today.
it feels like watching a long movie, doesn't it?
It really, well, you know, those hour-long time slots really make it nice. It's almost like watching a movie every time.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just want to go back to the idea of the crossroads demon. I had not been real familiar with the idea of specifically a demon at the crossroads. But I know, I mean, the crossroads has been significant in paranormal topics way, way back. I mean, Hecate was the ancient Greek goddess of the crossroads, and
mm-hmm.
she was pretty scary. She wasn't considered to be a demon. She was a goddess, but she was like the goddess of witchcraft and dark, evil things. And people were sometimes buried at a crossroads so that the ghost would be confused, wouldn't be able to find its way back to haunt people. So I'm thinking, after a while, there must have been a lot of graves at crossroads, which would make it even a little scarier. Actually, a lot. I mean, if you're trying to come home late at night and you come to a crossroads, that's where all the graves are, and you're thinking, great, now I got to pass this. I would be one of those people. I'd be like, okay, I'll go home tomorrow. Fine, I'm not going past.
On top of that, the kind of people who are buried at Crossroads are not good people usually. They're the ones you don't want
to find their way back. So.
Right, you know, they're, you know, people who killed their parents, rapists, murderers, and all kinds of horrible, horrible people were buried at Crossroads, and sometimes good people as well. But you know, I wouldn't really want to chance it. But from a supernatural point of view, I would not want to go near a Crossroads, like, you know, anywhere between, you know, 500 BC to now, you know, where any of those old crossroads where those people were buried, because they buried basically the people they didn't want nearby.
Yeah. And I would think, too, if you had groups of witches meeting, or, you know, maybe followers of Hecate, they might be coming from different places, and they might actually meet at a crossroads for the night either.
Yeah, I think, but, you know, the funny thing about that whole crossroads meeting for witches, you know, the funny thing is, I think that probably that was originally some kind of a purification rite being done by some pre-Christian religion, because the whole thing about witches meeting at the crossroads doesn't show up until the whole Demonologia text is written. I think it's a medieval text, but for some reason I cannot, for the life of me, remember the year, is when that first kind of pops up. And so, you know, you got to remember, a lot of what were called witches in the Middle Ages were the pre-Christian clergy, to be honest with you. They were the priestesses,
right,
and the shamans of the gods of the religion that was there before.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't really witches.
Yeah, I mean, they may have used the word. Other people used the word to describe them, and it's true. I think a lot of them were very pleasant, very harmless, helpful people, but I have to think that once the persecution started, that some of them thought it was okay to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably weren't all that, you know, sweetness and light once that got going. And, I mean, more power to them. They were fighting for survival. But I'm sure a lot of them started doing things that you and I probably would have been pretty afraid of coming across at the crossroads.
But couldn't we say the same about even the Christian clergy?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, they're any time you have a religious order, there are going to be those who are, you know, pious and devout, and then there will be those who are looking for a way to exploit that power, you know, that religion gives. Because religion really does give a person power.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there's I don't even have to give you evidence to back that up. I mean, that's just the truth, I think, at this point. You know, religion is power, and I think that, you know, that was just as true for probably the pre-pagan religion, or the pre-Christian religions, as it is, I think, now for the Christian clergy.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. On that note, Nathan, we need to take a break for the hour, and I want to thank everybody who's joined us for the first hour of Through the Keyhole here on the Paranormal Radio Network, and also on UPRN 105.7 FM in New Orleans. My guest this evening is Nathan Robert Brown, the author of The Mythology of Supernatural, The Signs and Symbols Behind the Popular TV Show. It's available now on Amazon, and I highly recommend it. I've read mine over several times already, and I love it. So during the break, go over to Amazon.com, check that out. We'll give you a few minutes to order the book, then come on back. And we've got another hour. We're going to be talking some more about Supernatural and all of the mythology and lore that went into it, so don't go too far.
blaming all on my roots. I showed up in boots and ruined your blind tie affair. The last one to know, the last one to show, I was the last one you thought you'd see there. And I saw the surprise and the fear in his eyes when I took his glass of champagne. I toasted you, said, hon, maybe through, but you'll never hear me complain. 'Cause I got friends in low places where the whiskey rounds and the beer chases my
blood. Well and truly locked up. So, thanks everyone for joining me for Through the Keyhole this evening. Welcome to the second hour. Nathan, are we back?
We are back.
Oh, good. I have a guest. Wonderful.
I find that helps.
That moment of panic, like, oh my God, is this working? Okay. So welcome back everyone to the second hour of Through the Keyhole on Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.7 FM in New Orleans. My guest this evening, for those of you who are just joining us, is Nathan Robert Brown, who is the author of the most amazing book I've read in quite a while, called The Mythology of Supernatural, The Signs and Symbols Behind the Popular TV Show. I am a huge fan of the TV show Supernatural, and apparently Nathan is as well. And on top of that, he's also a mythologist and a brilliant writer. So this guy not only knows his stuff, he knows how to write about it, he makes it fun. This is like a fabulous fix for anybody who is really missing the show over the summer while we're sitting around waiting for the next season to get started. You know, pick up this book. Go to Amazon and pick up Nathan Robert Brown's book. It is phenomenal. Nathan, I want to get back to where we were when we went to break. We were talking about witches and crossroads and all kinds of cool things. And there was a little question, and we kind of got into a bit of a thing about whether witches are good or bad and how they were, you know, the pre-Christian clergy, as you pointed out, and mainly did things like healing and positive magic. And I was saying that, you know, some of them probably once the persecutions got going, maybe not everything they did was super nice. And I don't want that to sound like I'm coming down hard on them. I don't think you ever... that you knew that I'm actually a Wiccan myself, so I'm totally, I totally get that. I'm sure they were very nice people who wanted to be left alone and just do nice things and help out their neighbors. But, you know, you get pushed to the wall. I have to admire anybody who pushed back a little.
Well, but, you know, I think that's true of anybody with a belief system. You know, there are always going to be people who want to take the passive road, because really in spirituality that is really the way that most religions say that passivity is the best. But at the same time, humans can only get pushed so far, and get, you know, the things that we believe, that's something we feel like that's what else is worth fighting for, if not that.
Exactly. And you know, all this passivity is the best, yeah, sometimes it is, but sometimes passivity is best for the guy who's got his foot on your neck. Yeah,
right.
Of course, I mean, he wants you to not fight back, to think that it's the best thing is just to endure. Yeah, sure, sometimes you really do need to fight back. But it didn't help in the long run, because, you know, all it did in a way was to bolster all the negative beliefs that people had about these early religions.
Well, you know, and that's something that I have a lecture that I give quite often. I call it the left-handed faith magic lecture, where I talk about what they refer to in voodoo as left-handed voodoo usage, which is, you know, basically destructive forms of faith magic. You know, things, basically what we would probably, most people would call black magic.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do those lectures, I spend probably the first 5 minutes explaining to people that this is not voodoo. The most people who practice faith magic are good people. They're healers. Most of them are very talented apothecaries. You know, they're incredible people for the most part who just want to practice their religion in peace. And even that little disclaimer at the beginning, at the end of the lecture when I do the Q&A, I always get these questions about, you know, well, you know, voodoo, all the, you know, what about voodoo dolls, you know, which is a total fabrication, and, you know, I get asked all these crazy questions about, you know, what about these cannibals in Africa? I'm like, voodoo's not African. It's Haitian. It's Caribbean. It came from Africa, but the stuff you're talking about isn't voodoo. And I still have to deal with this. And I think it's so funny because it's like when you talk about that one little bad part of a religion, any religious belief, not their religious belief, they tend to want to group everybody into that category.
Exactly. You know,
But what I think is so funny, and I hate to single them out, but I find that Christians tend to do this more than anyone. Not all of them, but I just find that people who are Christian have that tendency more often than not. And what I find interesting is that how many fringe Christian groups have there been that have done absolutely horrible things, the Branch Davidian group, etc. And no Christian would want to be grouped in with those people. No Christian would want to say, would want someone to go, well, you must be nuts because those people in Waco they were Christians and obviously they were crazy, so you must be crazy too. You know, they don't want people to lump them into categories, and yet they seem to tend to do it quite often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So we were talking about the crossroads in relation to witches and demons, and you were starting to tell me that you said something about the crossroads demon is a concept that's been around for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? How far back does that go? Do you know? Because I don't really know about the origins of that one.
Give me one second. the crossroads demon.
You're checking your book, aren't you?
Yes, I am, actually. Well, it's because I don't know the year or the time period. That's why I'm looking. The thing about crossroads, as far as like them actually being demons, you have to remember that at the time that the whole crossroads thing was begun, mm-hmm. they weren't demons at that point. The demons were not an idea yet. And that happens a lot with things we call demons now. Mm-hmm. They weren't considered demons at first. They were considered an embodiment of some kind of a negative force in nature. But they weren't considered evil necessarily. They were just part of the existence cycle. And
could that have come out of, as we were talking about in the first hour, the idea that people who died who were maybe less than savory, murderers, horrible people who for some reason or other people were concerned about their ghosts coming back and haunting and wanted to prevent that, these people would be buried at a crossroads, ideally so the spirit would be confused and they wouldn't be able to come back.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, maybe the idea could have built up that those angry ghosts were stuck there and became something bigger, or maybe even over time, the spirits that were stuck there really did become something worse, like in the idea of in Supernatural, where the black-eyed demons were human spirits who had been in hell too long and became something worse.
Well, I think the American interpretation of the crossroads demon definitely does come from that. But see, like in Europe, a crossroads was where leprechauns and fairies would congregate at the crossroads. And that's where we get the whole deal with the devil thing. That whole making a pact with the devil, that's really a Celtic and European idea that, you know, you come across a fairy spirit at the crossroads and they offer to do this for you, but, you know, they tell you they'll expect something later, but not right now, and then you find out they want your firstborn child, you know, something along those lines. And so that, I think, probably ended up coming to America along with this idea of, you know, the different types of spirits that were basically from all over the world that come to this melting pot of America. And so then Christianity comes along, you know, well, not that Christianity wasn't long before, but this belief in, you know, that anything that is not of Christianity is evil, and so it becomes, you know, the deal with a fairy folk becomes the deal with the devil.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and especially in Southern culture, you see this a lot, this whole idea of, you know, we met the devil at the crossroads, and, you know, you have the whole Robert Johnson story, that he was able to play the guitar as well as he did because he made a deal with the devil at the crossroads, you know, after his wife died in childbirth. So, you know, I think the funny thing about the crossroads is it seems to be every culture has a different interpretation. But what's funny is that when you look at the modern interpretation, it's almost like a strange kind of integration of little elements from all those different traditions all into one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the end of my answer.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sorry.
Sorry about that.
No, I went off on a bit of a tangent because that one episode, The Crossroads, was just, the music in itself was phenomenal in that episode. They really drew on history. And there again, you know, they drew on history and myth and, you know, culture. There was just so much. That episode in particular was so rich and just, there was just so much of it to experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's watching the story and watching the characters, which is great, but then the whole thing was this visual, auditory, amazing experience you could just let wash over you.
Mm-hmm. And I thought was great, you know.
I always feel like I come away having learned something about spirits and demons and whatever, even though I know it's a TV show, I know it's entertainment, but they drew on so much actual mythology that it's actually a great teaching tool for someone who doesn't know this stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And what I love about the show, this is one of the things that I always talk about with people, is that what they do is they tell you just enough to make you want to know more, but they don't tell you so much that you kind of get slapped in the face with all of it. You know, like in that Crossroads episode, you know, they mention Robert Johnson, and they mention his music, and Robert Johnson's music and different, you know, jazz music gets played throughout, and blues music gets played throughout that episode, but they talk about Robert Johnson, but they don't go into the details of the whole Robert Johnson story, which is something I do in the book. I was surprised at how prevalent that particular piece of the lore was, you know, especially in the music industry, you know, this whole idea that Robert Johnson, you know, died as a young man, you know, died a premature death. That was kind of unexplained, or at least under odd circumstances, and, you know, and it was because the devil came to get his due, you know. And it was also kind of an interesting thing because, you know, this young man who suffers a personal tragedy and disappears for, you know, I think about a year, and then he ends up coming back, and suddenly he can play the guitar, and how do you explain that? How does this guy, who was an okay guitar player before, disappears for a year and comes back, and he's the best guitar player you've ever seen? You know, Son House, who was one of the blues musicians that Robert Johnson went to when he was a young man, refused to teach him because he didn't think he had any talent. He was like, you can play guitar, but you're not that great, and just kind of dismissed him. And, you know, and then he comes back from this whole experience, and the next thing you know, he's touring the country with Son House, you know, playing on the same stage as this guy. And some people think that maybe that's where the story came from, that Son House could not figure out how this guy went from being just okay to just being a legendary guitar player and had to be something sinister. So, you know, he sold his soul to the devil.
Yeah, it's a wild story. I mean, I guess, you know, somebody who went through a loss like he did, he may have just gone away for a year, holed up, and just decided, I'm going to work on this guitar and I'm going to be the best there ever was, and this is just what I'm going to spend my time on. And yeah, maybe he could have accomplished something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you can totally see how, you know, going from being this sort of mediocre guy who really wanted to play a guitar to disappearing for a little while to then showing up as this absolute genius. You know, everybody who heard him must have thought, what did you do?
Where did this come from? How come, you know, and that's the thing, you know, not only...
Like, yeah, that's not possible. You must have made a deal with the devil.
Yeah, exactly. And then the truth is, a lot of people feel like probably Son House and Robert Johnson probably kind of helped this rumor along because it made him kind of a more mysterious character and the kind of guy people want to have around. You know what I mean? Kind of like one of those. He made him a little more taboo, and people always like, you know, the stuff that's kind of a little shady. You know, yeah. As a musician, it made him a little cooler.
Yeah.
You know, this guy. You know, he wrote all kinds of songs. You know, with occult stuff he wrote. And you know, a lot of his stuff talked about, you know, the devil showing up, and, you know, it was just an interesting take on it. It almost, you know, obviously none of these songs were supposed to be autobiographical, but then later on people were like, oh, okay, now we see, you know.
Yeah, it does make sense. So, okay, I have to ask a personal question then. What's your favorite episode?
Oh, good Lord.
Oh,
or a story arc. I mean, let's not get it down to a specific episode because
I think it's a tie. I think it's a tie actually between, because I really like the more comical episodes. I really do, and I think it's a tie between Yellow Fever, just because of the scream that comes out of Jensen Ackles or Dean Winchester in that movie, and also the Eye of the Tiger lip sync at the end of that episode. I absolutely love that. And Clap Your Hands If You Believe, or Fight the Fairies is what I think most people are calling it now, which was the fairy episode in season 6. I think it's kind of a tie between those two. I love both of those episodes.
Now, in Yellow Fever, that was I'm just, because a lot of my listeners have already said on the chat room that they're not real familiar with the TV show. So...
Well, Yellow Fever, we're talking about
spoilers like crazy. I'm just trying to kind of...
Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it. Well, Yellow Fever is someone gets what they call ghost sickness. Obviously something completely made up by the show. We finally found something. And basically it's like a virus that a ghost gives a person, and it can be spread from person to person under certain circumstances. And this particular one makes people afraid because the ghost that's doing it was just died in a very, very panicked and terror-stricken situation. And so the sheriff in this town, who was one of the people responsible for the man's death, that is the ghost, is scratching his arm and has all these marks on his arm, and is real germaphobic, and he's really odd. And they shook hands. Dean shakes hands with him, and he ends up catching it. And it basically makes you, it just scares you to death. Basically, you become seemingly afraid to where, like, a week later, you're dead of a heart attack. And so, you know, Dean just continually starts getting more and more afraid of everything, which, as you can imagine, in their job, not the best thing, to be easily frightened in a job where you're chasing ghosts. And, there's some really great dialogue in that episode, and there's a scene where they open a locker, and... They hear something in the locker, they open it, and this cat jumps out, and Dean lets loose with this 15-second-long, girlish squeal scream, and he's jumping up and down, and he's, you know, waving his flashlight in the air, and it's just absolutely hilarious. And he's like, that was scary, and it's just a really funny episode, and I enjoy the comic humor of the show, because... You know, they could have made this the kind of show that's just very, very dark and violent, and they throw in, I think, just the amount of comic relief to make it watchable and not campy.
Yeah, it's interesting how this is a show that deals with, you know, demons rising out of hell and the end of the world coming, and in fact, you know, we go right up to the brink of it, and it's still funny. It has a lot of really funny moments.
Oh, there are hilarious moments in the show. I laugh at least, you know, every episode. I think they at least get one really good laugh in there. And and you know, the funny thing is, you know, the Dean Winchester, the Jensen Ackles plays, you know, that character is really a very soft. Most of the funny stuff that comes out of the show comes out of his mouth. I mean, just absolutely hilarious lines they write for that character. And I love them.
And that was one of the. In the later seasons, Castiel gets quite a lot of the funny lines as well. Although
yes,
it doesn't seem like he intends them. They're just really funny the way he says them.
Yeah, he very much has that whole comic straight man thing going on. You know, the stuff that comes out as if it's not supposed to be funny, but it makes it hilarious. And, I absolutely love that. And, you know, that was one of the things I noticed when I started researching the show and was writing the book. At first, I didn't have the quotes in... the book, but as
you had to sit down and watch them all over again to find your quote.
I did. Well, the thing that was so funny. Well, I noticed that the fans of the show, as I was talking to them, a lot of times they would say something to each other, and then they would say something from an episode I hadn't seen yet, and so it didn't make sense to me when I'd see it the first time. And then I'd come back and be like, okay, you know,
right.
Of course I peed myself. You know, like that was like there was a line. And I read this little what they were talking about. But at the time, I was like, that is the most random thing I've ever heard.
No, it just had this hidden meaning. And yeah, once you've seen all the episodes and you're in the club, then it makes total sense.
Exactly, that's why I put the quotes in there.
Yeah, well, I love the way you've got the quotes kind of peppered all through the bone. There's a great one here from Crowley, one of the demons. Let's just say when they get their Grammy, they shouldn't all be thanking God.
Yes,
I really like
one
that.
Of my favorite lines.
Yeah.
Crowley's
one of my favorite characters, I have to say. He's phenomenal.
Yeah, Bobby Singer, I think, gave me some of the really good ones, you know. Like, you know, are you idiots trying to kill me? And get off my property before I pump you so full of rock salt, you crap margaritas. You know,
yeah.
Those are great lines. I love those lines.
Yeah, Bobby's wonderful. So, okay, people, anybody listening, if you haven't seen Supernatural yet, you have no excuse. It's on DVD. Okay, you can get the DVDs on Amazon. You can get them at your library. Go get them and watch them in order, right? None of this, you know, jumping in, skipping around. You got to start with season one, episode one, and go straight through.
Oh, you really do. When I first started watching, I started watching during season four, and I realized right then I watched two episodes, and I was like, I can't do this. I haven't have to go back and watch all of them, so I had to go back. And watch from season one and then catch back up and towards the end of season four. Because you really can't just, I mean, you can, but it's not nearly as good if you don't understand the whole backstory. And it's a very, very complex backstory at this point.
Yeah. And there, you know, I just always like, I'm one of those people who will always start a book at the beginning and I read it straight through.
Mm-hmm.
And I have friends, I know somebody who will pick up a mystery book that she's never read before, and she'll read the end to see if she likes it, and if she doesn't, she'll start at the beginning. I'm like,
no.
How can you do that? Sucked all the fun out of it right
there.
My attitude is some author spent God knows how long writing the book and presenting it exactly this way, so I'm going to read it the way they wanted it read.
Sometimes I find myself wishing they hadn't.
Yeah.
I was talking to a friend of mine about that last week. I was telling him, you know, what I hate is I always have to finish a book. And so if I'm reading a book and I get like you know, 50 pages into it and I start to just absolutely just don't like the book, I will still read it to the end. Even though I can't stand it, I make myself read it.
I did that, I think, one time, and I was so annoyed at myself for wasting the time on it. I said, that's it. Next time I got a couple chapters in, I said, this isn't going anywhere. I don't like this book, and I just put it down. I think it was a library book, so I'm like, I didn't even spend any money on this. It's just going back.
Oh, see, that's I need to use the library more often.
Well,
I'm so irresponsible, though, with books. I'm always afraid that, like, I'm going to get a library book and forget I have to turn it back in, and, like, they're going to send the police after me.
I think they just make you pay for the book if you don't pick it back.
Yeah, no, it's a totally irrational fear, you know, that I'm going to get a library book, forget about it, find out I owe, like, you know, my firstborn child for the book.
Yeah. No, see, part of the problem with using the library, though, for those of us who are into these esoteric topics, is that some libraries don't carry the kind of books we're interested in. So, you know, I'm finding some books I have to order off the internet. A lot of things on paranormal. Well, it's getting better now, but frequently there are specific books that I want, and I have to order them directly from the authors because libraries don't carry stuff like that because they think nobody's interested.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, somebody on the chat room just said the books we like get stolen from the library. That's true.
That happens a lot. It really does.
Because we have such great taste. We like all the best stuff, and you know, so that goes. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, and we're down in the last half hour now, and I did want to ask you to talk a bit about Lilith, because she was such a major character in Supernatural for a while, and also because she was a major part of your research before you got involved in the TV show Supernatural. You had actually written a book about Lilith.
I came across the Lilith character, I want to say in my early 20s, in a fiction book that was about vampires. And I think it was part of the whole like Vampire Masquerade RPG that they had back in the 90s, and I was reading this book, and I felt like I had heard the name before, and I realized it was the lady from Cheers, and then I was like, that's kind of odd, and so that ended up leading me to what ended up becoming like a 7-year journey of researching this character, because first, you know, I find her in her usual place, which is in Judaism as a female demon seductress. And then I realized that that's not where she started. And I ended up looking further and further back, and I find out that she's been in mythology since at least 5,000 B.C., if not probably several thousand years before that, before it was written down in cuneiform on ancient tablets in Mesopotamia. The interesting thing is when she first shows up in mythology, she is in a garden with a special tree called the Halupu tree, and this woman or this goddess named Inanna is trying to basically use the tree to make a bed chamber and a throne and several other like items of civilization. So she finds this tree and has it planted in what they refer to as her holy garden, and this is going to come back later. So she gives it 10 years to mature, and when she comes back, she finds Wing in the trunk, or had made the trunk her home, is that what it really says. And in the roots of the tree, there's a serpent, a snake, and in the branches of the tree is a mythological bird called a zoo bird, or an anzu, which is kind of like a griffin. And Inanna, who is the most powerful goddess in this pantheon, is unable to eject Lilith or the other creatures from the tree, and has to go basically get help from her male relative Gilgamesh, who was a warrior god, who had this humongous, ridiculously heavy axe and armor, and you know, he hits the snake and the zoo bird, and its chicks fly away, and Lilith runs off into what they say are the wild, uninhabited lands. And then Lilith disappears in mythology. It doesn't show up again until Judaism. And I couldn't figure out why the gap. Why this several thousand year gap between the first time she shows up and the next? And what I realized was there was a clue in there where they say that Lilith goes off into these wild and uninhabited lands. At this time, gods were associated with geographic locations. You know, you went to a certain city in order to worship a certain god because that was that city's god. The god was actually in the city. And so to say that Lilith was sent into the wild uninhabited lands would mean that she was sent out of the city. Which means if you want to worship Lilith, you've got to leave. And so what I believe is that this story was written to tell the members of the Lilith cult that if you want to worship your goddess, you guys got to go. And you have to understand the world of 5000 BC is a world that none of us can even really understand, a world completely devoid of law outside of the cities.
Yeah.
Once you left the city, like let's say you even wanted to move from one city to another, unless you took a special road under protection, there was nothing to help you. If you were outside of the city and someone decided they liked your stuff, or your wife, or your children, there was nothing to stop them from putting a sticky object of their choice through your chest, selling your family into slavery, and keeping all your stuff for themselves. I mean, you couldn't call the police, you couldn't call 911. Dangerous world to live in. And the funny thing is, I believe the members of the Lilith cult did make the journey, despite how perilous it was.
That's pretty amazing.
Well, see, in the Eastern dialect of Mesopotamia at that time, Lilith's name was Kal. And what I believe is that we also learned that we didn't know this until recently, that there was trade going on between the Hindu Kush, between India and ancient Mesopotamia. We had no idea until recently. A cylinder seal was found with elephants on it in Mesopotamia.
Oh.
The thing is, there are no elephants in Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
So the only place they could have seen an elephant and even known that they existed was in India at that time.
Uh-huh.
So they were actually trading with India in the ancient world. And so I believe that some of these followers went to India, and that's where Kali came from.
The destroyer goddess.
Right. A destroyer goddess who's black as night. Lilith means dark, the dark maiden.
Mm-hmm.
Lilith actually means night. And Kali is night.
Right. And when Lilith turned up again in Judaism, she was a demon.
Not at first. At first she was human.
Oh, okay.
She was the first wife of Adam. And most people are like, wait a minute, I've read Genesis. I know that's not there. And you're right, it's not in there anymore. They had it removed. Most likely in the original Genesis myth, when it was written by the Jews, they used the Huluku tree story as a template. And wife of Adam. She was made from the ground in the same way that Adam was. And because of that, she didn't feel that Adam was anything special. She didn't think he was had the right to tell her what to do or
she was
to,
his equal.
Yeah, in her mind. And to be honest, she was actually kind of better than he was in a few ways. But Adam, there are different versions of the story, but most of them basically say that Adam wanted to be on top during sex and Lilith said no. And so Adam tries to force himself on Lilith, at which point Lilith speaks out the unspeakable name of God, basically the name of God that's basically it's impossible for a human being to say that name. How in the world does she know how to do that? And she goes up into heaven, though, and she's rescued by the hand of God. But the God says to her, you know, hey, you need to go back to Eden and play nice with Adam. And she says no. Well, Old Testament God didn't really like being told no. So he was just big.
By a woman.
Yeah, as Joshua refers to it, he was good with the whole wrath thing back then, and he banishes her into the desert, and curses her with giving birth to 100 stillborn babies every day, and so she wanders through the desert giving birth to dead babies until she starts heading towards the Red Sea or the Sea of Reeds. And God sends three separate angels, who make the same offer to her. Come back to Eden, play nice with Adam, do what he tells you, and everything's forgiven. And she basically gives all three of them the finger. She's like, no, I'm good. And she gets all the way to the Sea of Reeds.
You know?
You really do. Well, you know, people say, you know, that's rebellion. I'm like, really? Not wanting to go back to a place with a guy who's tried to rape you? I don't really think of that as rebellion. I kind of think of it as common sense, but...
Well,
finally,
a lot of strength because I mean there wasn't anything else. She's out wandering the desert by herself, as opposed to living in the garden with a companion, and all she had to do was say, "Okay, fine, you're right. I'll be good. I'll do what you said." And she couldn't do that. She was too strong and too independent. She said, "You know what? I'll wander in the desert. I'm good." That's pretty cool.
Well, and the great thing is she finally reaches the shore of the Sea of Reeds, and God gets kicked off with these three angels. Their names are Sanvi, Sansanvi, and Samangalef. And he tells them, look, you go talk to her again, and this time, if she doesn't come back, kill her.
Whoa.
Either bring her back alive, or you bring her back dead. And so they go back.
Really, he couldn't tolerate anybody disobeying.
Oh, no. He was really ticked off with it. Things get weird. The angels catch up to Lilith at the shore of the Red Sea. And they say, come with us or we'll drown you right here in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of my favorite lines of the alphabet of Ben Sira. She turns to the angels and says, my little darlings. She refers to three warrior angels as my little darlings. and says, don't you fools know that God created me to be the bane of mothers and childbirth? And that I have the right to take the life of babies if male born up to the 8th day, if female born up to the 12th day, and I think I got the math right on that, I'm not sure. But then they restrain her, and they tell her that anywhere that she sees their likenesses, and the words barring Lilith, either written on the wall of a house or on an amulet, she can't go near there. And she agrees, and they release her, and she goes off and jumps into the Red Sea, And that's kind of the end of the story. Well, the interesting thing is that in Judaism, to this day, in Hasidic Jews and Orthodox Jews, wear amulets, expectant mothers wear amulets with the likenesses of these three angels and the words barring Lilith on them. And sometimes they'll have them on the floor underneath the bed when they're giving birth, and it's incredible.
Wow.
And it's still perpetuated to this day. Even though Lilith doesn't even exist in any of the canonical Jewish texts, it's still part of the culture.
They're still not taking that chance.
All right. But the funny thing is that they ruin all these texts, and so the only places you can find them is in the non-canonical texts, like the Zohar, the alphabet of Ben Sira, a lot of the Kabbalah texts have, and even in the Midrash text, they are references to Lilith. But she's not in the Bible, and she's not in the Torah. That's the interesting thing about it, is that they every culture that has ever come, every male-dominated culture who's ever come across Lilith has done their best to get rid of her, and they fail every single time. Right now, she's been in mythology for at least 7,000 to 8,000 years. That's longer than any other character in mythology. She's been around longer than anybody.
That is amazing. Now, when they brought her into the TV show Supernatural, they did make an effort to portray her as this very strong character. You know, mm-hmm. She was, even demons were describing her as, you know, she is the baddest of the bad down here. She's scary. She scared the demons. But didn't really get an opportunity to bring all that history out to really explain who she was or where she came from.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, a lot of people believe that there's a part in Revelations that talks about, like, the Whore of Babylon. Mm-hmm. And some people think that Lilith is the Whore of Babylon. Because to the Jews, all Mesopotamians were Babylonians, as far as they were concerned. Mm-hmm. If you lived in ancient Mesopotamia and you weren't a Jew, you were Babylonian, as far as they were concerned. And so some people think that maybe that's where the whole Whore of Babylon thing comes from Revelations, that maybe that's where St. John got that from. And there are Jewish texts that talk about the Lilith of the desert, that basically when the end times do come, she will rise up out of the desert with her Lilim, which is a class of demons in Judaism, and she'll rise up out of the desert and leave her horde of demonic brood against the world.
Yikes.
And, she's
fairly,
a scary lady.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, you know, the thing is interesting, you know, like, by the time the Jews were done with her, you know, she went from the human to kind of a cursed human, and then they had made her pretty much the wife of every big-shot demon in their demonology. I mean, the woman's got more husbands than you can imagine. And, you know, she's a part of, she actually is the female half of the Leviathan. Like, her and her husband, the Demon King, put together are the slant serpent Leviathan that's spoken of in Revelations.
Mm-hmm. Now, may that be harking back to earlier traditions that were matrilinear and matriarchal, mm-hmm. where the power was passed through the female, and mm-hmm. there were ancient traditions in some cultures where the male leader, the king, had to have a ritual marriage to the goddess in order to take power.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, and that was huge in Mesopotamia as well.
Yeah, so it's interesting that Lilith has been allegedly married to all these different demon gods. It's almost as if they got their power because they were married to her.
Mm-hmm. And she's the, let's see, I know one of her husbands is Ashmedai, and he's a pretty big one. He's scary. I actually consulted on a case where, a demonology case, where it was suspected that that was the demon involved.
You can't go on now. I have to hear about that.
Well, actually, believe it or not, the lady that I consulted with actually wrote a book about the whole thing, and it sounds kind of silly when you say it, but basically they thought their dog was possessed. And I don't think the dog was possessed necessarily, but I do think something was trying to get to the family, the dog.
Okay.
And the way that some of the situations where, like, the dog's shadow basically wasn't the dog, it was a three-headed, like, serpent-type, serpent-lion-mix-looking-type creature, and there was a time when the dog's body, this is according to witnesses, I was not there for this, okay? This is just according to the account that I was given, where the dog's body basically doubled in length. And Ashmedai is said to have, like, the neck of a serpent and the three heads, like, he can be one of them, which is a lion. To be honest, most of what they told me kind of sounded like his area, but I wasn't a direct consult on that. I was just, I was consulted really after the fact, just to kind of, as a validity thing, to validate all the research.
And this woman wrote a book on this?
Yes, she did. Yeah, she did.
Do you know what the book is called? I'm sorry.
Paranormal Pooch.
Paranormal Pooch. Okay.
Yes, it's the name of the book. I've never not read this book. I'm not endorsing the book. I know nothing about this book. I just know that she wrote one. So, you know, buy at your own peril. I don't know anything about this book. I'm not saying that it's bad. I don't want people to feel like I'm endorsing this book because I've never so much as cracked the cover. I have no idea what's in the book. So if you go out and buy this book and you're like, this is horrible, you can't blame me. I didn't know. I'm not saying that it is horrible. For all I know, it's great, but I've never read it, so I have no idea.
Yeah, and I have a feeling this is one of those, like we were talking about earlier, that my library is not going to have this one. I'm willing to
possibly
bet.
Not. this lady's going to be so mad at me.
Well, no, I mean, book sales might just shoot up after this. You know, we're all I'm going to check it out.
All right.
I have to now. Yeah. I have to know. Holy, that's really something.
Yeah.
Nathan, we have about 3 minutes left.
Okay.
And, my God, the second hour has just blown right by. I'm just having so much fun. Just trying to... Anything... Oh, I knew what I wanted to ask you. Because you have done a lot of study in mythology and in all of these related topics before you started watching the show Supernatural. And the TV show is about these two brothers. For the benefit of new listeners, I'm seeing more and more people in the chat room as time goes on. So we're talking about Supernatural, which is a story of two brothers who are paranormal investigators, you might say, but they take it further. They call themselves hunters, and they actually go after these monsters and kill them. We've been talking during the whole show about the reality of the legends and the myths that these monsters have been drawn from. Now, you just mentioned that you were called in to consult on a demonology case, and I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on whether any of these creatures or monsters or spirits are actually real. Do you think any of this actually exists in the real world, or is it all, you know, on TV and in books?
Are you asking me if I believe that demons exist?
Any of these. You know,
I believe in the existence of supernatural evil. Yes, I think that demons are a very real thing. I don't think they're everywhere. I'm not a member of the devils and everything group. Okay, I just know they exist because I've seen them. You know, not seeing them with my eyes, seeing them, but I've seen situations where they've been involved. And so, yes, I believe they are real. As far as like the creatures are concerned, now I'm a big fan of cryptozoology. Also a big fan of not believing in anything until I saw it. At the same time, you know, I think there's more to this planet. We like to believe we've seen it all and we've heard it all, but most people don't realize that there are new species of animal still being found all the time. You know, we like to think that we know anything and everything there is to know about this planet, but we're still learning that, you know, they thought the Japanese drill shark was extinct until a few years ago when one washed up after a hurricane.
Yeah. And the coelacanth, we thought, had been extinct for, you know, what, millions of years. I mean, that was ridiculous until somebody found one. A fisherman caught one.
Wow.
Can you imagine seeing that?
That would blow my mind.
Wow. It's just phenomenal. Because it's like you have to push the reset button on every preconceived idea that you ever had about the world.
Right.
You know? Everything you thought you knew might be wrong now.
Right. So my general policy is keep an open mind, but at the same time, you know, follow the evidence.
Yeah.
That's always been kind of my policy as far as things are concerned. I won't ever say that I don't believe anything's possible, that it's possible that something could exist. I mean, for all I know, anything could possibly exist, but I won't say that it does until I've seen it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that sounds like a really great place to wrap up. Nathan, I just need to pass on one message from the chat room. One of our listeners says, please relay to the author. Go to Google search images and look at Mars Wolfman.
Mars Wolfman.
Myself, too. He doesn't really say anything about it. He just says, go to Google search images and look up Mars Wolfman.
Mars Wolfman as in M-A-R-S, as in the planet?
Yeah.
Okay, Mars Wolfman. I will do so. Wolfman is one word or two.
Wolfman is written as one word.
Okay, gotcha. All right, I will definitely check that out.
Okay. And on that note, we need to head out because there's another show getting ready to start up after us.
Nathan, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I can't tell you again how much I've enjoyed your book and talking with you. It's been really fantastic. Thank you.
I've enjoyed it as well. Thank you so much for having me on.
Great. Have a great evening. Okay. And thanks to everybody who joined us this evening for Through the Keyhole. This has been another live show here on Oral Radio Network. And you can also hear us on UPRN 105.7 FM in New Orleans. Archives are available on Black Vault Radio Network at www.theblackvault.com. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and I want to thank my guest, Nathan Robert Brown, one more time. And to all of you, thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned now for Global Focus, coming up next with Trisha Sheridan. Thanks.
Shop of yellow making toys for the good Gentile girls and the good Gentile boys. When the boss busted in, nearly scared him half to death. Had his head and cheap whiskey on his breath. From his beer boots, he was covered as drunk, disgruntled, yuletide gumbo. And he smiled as he said, with a twinkle in his eye, Merry Christmas, all, now you're all gonna die.